Welcome back. It's another week here at Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, editors, sound mixers, composers, authors, you know, and of course, some of my faves, the VFX gurus, you name it, and we talk to them all. And I've been doing a lot of talking the past few weeks, a little slow at getting some stuff up on the website, but trying to make up for it on the show each week with some of these pre-recorded exclusive interviews. And we'll be kicking off today's show with one of those. But let me tell you what's coming up in the second half of the show. Richard Ryan will be joining us live. Richard is a producer, a writer, a director, an editor, and an actor. And he's going to be joining us to talk about his new film. It started streaming last month. It is called Art of Deception, an action thriller. And he's wearing all those hats in this action thriller. It's got a great premise. The third act is really wonderful. He's got some montages in that third act that are just spectacular. One of which he could lift out of there and make into a short film if he would ever choose to do so. And I want to talk to him about that. But Richard will be joining us at the midpoint of the show. Before that, you're going to hear from my exclusive interview with director Thea Sharrock talking about the smash hit, the fabulous, the wickedly delicious and delightful Wicked Little Letters, which is out now. One of my favorite films of the year by far. But before I get into that, with TCM Film Festival coming up on April the 18th in Hollywood at the Chinese Theater again. And now this year, the Egyptian Theater, now that the remodel is finished, the Cinematheque, Netflix, they are joining with TCM and a lot of screenings, nitrate screenings, will be at the Egyptian. So looking forward to that. And I'll be talking more about TCM Film Festival. Still waiting for the lineup of stars that will be on the red carpet opening night. So far, we have John Travolta coming opening night. So that will be good. But with TCM around the corner, it's sad. We're watching so many legends of Hollywood pass. Most recently, just this weekend, yesterday, Barbara Rush passed away. 97 years old. Phenomenal actress. Seven decades she spanned on the big screen, the small screen, theater. Most recently, over the past couple years, you may have seen her on television in the Los Angeles area for a coin and jewelry store that buys coins and jewelry. And the commercials are very, very, very funny. And Barbara was just a delight in them. But, you know, at multiple TCM festivals, she has been there for dinner. She has been there for poolside gatherings. It's going to be sad at this TCM without Barbara there. But for me, a bigger loss is Lou Gossett Jr. I had the pleasure of speaking with Lou numerous times over the years and numerous times at TCM Film Festival. He was a joy, a delight. I loved speaking with him about his approach to the industry. Having seen so much of it transform, Lou had very definite opinions and an incredible outlook and approach to acting. Many of you, for my money, as wonderful as he is in his Oscar-winning performance in An Officer and a Gentleman, it was his performance in The Cuban. In 2019, I believe, The Cuban came out, Sergio Narvaez's film. For me, for my money, that is the finest performance of Lou Gossett Jr.'s career. If you haven't seen it, I can't recommend it highly enough. Please, please, do yourself a favor, find it and see it. And it makes his passing now even more poignant to see the character that he played in The Cuban. But Lou will be very, very missed. Some of my interviews with Lou, my red carpet interview with Barbara, they are all up on BehindTheLensOnline.net right now. You can just go to the site and in the search bar, type in their names, and it'll bring up some of the interviews, especially those TCM red carpet ones. And then a real loss for me, and I didn't mention this last week because we were jammed for time. I have a little bit of a breather today. Emmett Walsh, the legendary M. Emmett Walsh. You know him. Over 250 television shows, over 150 films over the course of his career. One of the greatest character actors of our generation. And he was a friend, a dear friend of mine. I knew Emmett for many, many years. We never did a formal sit-down interview because we always chatted as friends. He lived very, very close to me. We would go to the same local establishment and just sit and talk for hours. Emmett would have his Coke, his Coca-Cola. I would have my whatever I'm drinking. And one of the greatest things with Emmett that you could always count on, he always carried a current double-sided resume in his wallet, in his pocket. So anybody that would ask, he would, you know, oh, well, what have you done? Which was, anybody that would ever ask Emmett that, what have you done? They should not have been talking to the man, because every one of you, I guarantee it, every one of you listening now, you have seen Emmett in something and you know who he is. But he would pull it out of his pocket and say, here, look. Just too funny. And something, and you've heard me talk about this here on the show before with filmmakers, some filmmakers, Emmett was in their film. And I would always just ask, say, so, how many $2 bills did you see? Because this was a custom and practice of Emmett's. He would pay for things. He would tip out servers, bartenders, on crews. He would give people $2 bills. This was just a great thing that he did, a novelty that he did. And for those of you that don't know, yes, there are $2 bills, and yes, they are legal tender, and yes, you can spend them. But just so funny, and I know that there were so many servers that they would look forward to that. They would look forward to waiting on Emmett to get that $2 bill. Emmett, he also collected coins. And he and I had many conversations about coin collecting because my grandfather was a noted coin stamp collector back in his day. And I have collections of steel pennies. Emmett always carried some steel pennies in his pocket. We were both in the grocery store one day, and he goes, oh, I have something for you. We were in front of the refrigerated section in front of the hot dogs, mind you. And he says, here. He goes, I don't know how many I've given you, but you can always use one more. And he handed me another steel penny. So I have a little box of Emmett's steel pennies and $2 bills. I was fortunate enough that he graced me with $2 bills on many an occasion around the holidays. But the nicest guy, he'd love to come across as curmudgeonly, but truly, truly, one of the nicest guys you will ever hope to meet, ever work with, and it is a real loss to the industry and for those of us that had the privilege of knowing Emmett for so long. So, just three incredible talents. Look for their stuff. See it. And watch it. And you'll see why their legacy lasted so long. And now, we're going to go more upbeat here. We're going to talk about Wicked Little Letters. You've seen the commercials. You've seen the trailer. You've heard on the radio the promos. This is To Die For. To Die For. I laughed so hard, I had to watch the film a second time to get all the comedy. Stars Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley as our two main characters. Olivia plays Edith Swan. Jesse plays Rose Gooding. This is set in 1920s English seaside town. This is a true story, people. Based on the true story, these two neighbors, Edith, deeply conservative, downtrodden, lived at home with her elderly parents, very put upon, single, spinster, miserable. And then Irish immigrant Rose Gooding, who's played by Jesse Buckley. Well, one day, all the townspeople start receiving these quote-unquote wicked letters that are so hilariously profane. You think what you read on social media now and how you hear people talk now, this takes profanity to new levels. Old English profanity. And it's hilarious. So everybody gets all these letters and they think that Rose is the one who's sending these letters. Rose says, no, it's not her. And all the letters, of course, are anonymous. It becomes a national situation. There is a trial. But then there is the first female police officer in the UK, Gladys Moss. And she was always called Woman Police Officer Gladys Moss. Gladys Moss is put upon, she's treated like crap by the police chief and her other male officers. But she starts to investigate the letters because something just doesn't add up. So she joins forces with three other ladies in the community. Mabel, wonderfully played by Eileen Atkins, who was a treasurer. Joanna Scanlon, who plays Anne, and Alicia Weir, who plays... I didn't even jot down who our third cohort is, teaming up with police officer Gladys Moss. But they start uncovering certain things that lead them all to believe Rose is not the culprit. Foul Language is a character in this. This is written by Johnny Sweet, directed by Thea Sharrock. Johnny is a well-known comedian. This is his first screenplay. You would never know it. It's that good. One of the great things is that all of these letters that we do hear, people reading, surreptitiously writing, talking about, the language that you see in here, the context, it's verbatim from the actual letters from the 1920s, which makes it even funnier. Production-wise, you've got the incredible Ben Davis, who you know from Seven Psychopaths, Banshees of Inisherin, Age of Ultron, Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. The visual grammar is distinctive with two looks, one for Edith, one for Rose. The lighting tells its own story. Color comes into play here. Production design is by Christina Casali. Costumes, Charlotte Walter. And Melanie Oliver, who has cut films like Jane Eyre, Anna Karenina, Les Miserables, and the acclaimed Judy, starring Renee Zellweger. It is rapier. The pacing is rapier, but it builds to these great outbursts of profanity. This is just one. You will have more fun watching this film than any other film you will possibly see this year. It is fantastic. And at the same time, as much fun as it is, the thematics are, it tackles freedom of speech, oppression, discrimination in the workplace, socioeconomic discrimination, discrimination against women. And we have a lot of the guys looking like misogynistic pigs. And that means the constable and his officers. But it is to die for fun. So right now, I'll stop blathering. Just sit back and take a listen to my exclusive interview with director Thea Sharrock talking about the divine Wicked Little Letters. Hi, Thea.
Hi, Debbie.
I can't tell you how thrilled I am to speak with you about Wicked Little Letters. I don't remember when I have laughed.
You can say anything if you start a sentence with that.
I can't remember the last time I laughed that hard for that long. I had tears rolling down my cheeks. This is... It's just beyond wickedly delicious. It is hilarious. I have not laughed so hard in I don't know when. Thank you, thank you, thank you for this film.
Honestly, anytime. And feel free to go back and watch it again.
Oh, don't worry, I will. This is just, it is incredible. From a comedy standpoint, a comedic standpoint, it is masterful. Your editor, Melanie, has cut this so rapier. And the pacing is done so well as it builds to outburst. You're looking forward to when we're going to hear more. We're going to read more and see it in a letter or hear more spout from somebody's mouth. This could not have been easy to pull off from performance to the cutting room.
No, you know, you're right. It's never easy, but this one was a real pleasure. I mean, the script was fantastic to read right from the get-go. Olivia was already attached, so that was a huge head start. And then we got Jesse very quickly after that. And from there, honestly, the casting just fell into place. And, you know, if you have a script like that, and you're able to get the caliber of actors that I was blessed to have on this, it makes my job a lot easier, I'll tell you that much.
The cadence and delivery of each of the actors is phenomenal. But one thing that I particularly love here is not only do you have the actors as characters, but the foul language itself is a character, as are the actual letters. Actually seeing so many of those letters, little excerpts or handwriting, it adds so much depth to the overall theme and story. It's brilliant, brilliantly conceived that way.
Oh, well, that's amazing. Thank you so much. It's so lovely to hear this.
What was this process like once you get this amazing cast in line, as if Olivia and Jesse aren't enough? All I saw was you had Gemma Jones and Eileen Atkins, and I'm there. I'll see anything that they're in. And neither one disappointed, particularly Eileen as Mabel, because all Eileen has to do is lower her chin, lower her eyes, and give this sideways glance, and you know, and you can't help but laugh.
I know the one you mean.
Yes. It's just...
She was phenomenal. If I tell you that after she agreed to do the part, I went round to her house and we sat for an afternoon and went through every single scene that she was in and every line that she spoke and talked about it. And, you know, we had a sort of amazing private rehearsal, I suppose.
Wow.
And that's how generous she is and hardworking she is. And I mean... It's a real privilege to work with somebody who simply has the years of experience that she does. So she was a fantastic ensemble member. And, you know, the other thing about Eileen is there were a lot of scenes with lots of the women.
Yes.
So it meant that they spent a lot of time together. And almost always I would go into when we were, you know, if we were sort of setting up for the next shot or whatever, and so they would all go off and sit together in the green room. And whenever I went in to go and get somebody or all of them or just see how they were or whatever, of course it would always be Eileen sitting there telling yet another amazing story everybody else. Just, you know, you could hear a pin drop. All of that goes into creating an atmosphere on set. And I think you can feel that in the performances somehow.
Oh, absolutely. And particularly when we get Anjana, when we get her, Eileen, Joanna Scanlon, and Lolly Adifo. We get those four together, and it reminded me very much of The Music Man and all the gossipy ladies and the things that were happening. But they just feed off of each other. And this is where your visual grammar and your work with Ben Davis, who is a god, as a cinematographer, what you do with your camera angles, you have distinct visual grammar for everybody. Olivia's Edith is shot one way. Jesse's Rose is shot another way. You get the group of women and they are shot another way, always full on straight, you know, front facial camera. Whereas Edith, we get a lot of her up high, looking down, spying. We get Rose, who's very free form. It looks like we had a lot of shoulder rig and handheld happening to really open up Rose's world. But the visual grammar then comes into play here based on your characters. And I think it is one of the most well-plotted and planned and designed examples of the importance of the camera that I've seen in many a film.
Amazing to hear. Thank you so much for recognizing all of that and for sharing that. I did put a lot of effort into putting my team of designers, but that includes Ben. So I had Ben and Christina, my production designer, and Charlotte, my costume designer, and even Denise, my hair and makeup designer. You know, we would sit together either in person or on Zoom just to make sure that we were all making the same movie together, you know, that we were making it as a team so that the aesthetic was all coming from one place. And we made a lot of, you know, we made choices together about color and about the camera and about how wide we would go. And you know, so, I mean, color in particular is a really, really important question.
Mm-hmm.
When you're shooting on digital and you have the control in a way that you do, but I wanted it to be as real as possible. So the colors that we chose for, whether it's the costumes or buildings or, you know, inside the houses and how different they were, you know, we really pored over those, again, as a team,
mm-hmm.
so that it was clear to everybody how I saw it. Everybody was seeing the same thing, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And that really comes through, especially when we look at the lighting in particular, when we're inside the Swan house versus when we're inside Rose's house. And that difference in lighting, even though the layouts are kind of like flip of each other, it's the same layout just like on opposite sides, but the lighting and the color then speaks volumes as to Rose, Nancy, and Rose's boyfriend versus the Swan family. And that was so striking to see. And the color and the light, it's all due to the color and the light. And that's I was very impressed by that care.
Again, thank you so much for recognizing all of that, because yes, of course, so much thought goes into making those decisions. So it's amazing to hear it be so recognized and appreciated.
I like how you kept a lot of red out of it, but for the mail postbox off the mailboxes.
That was another big choice.
because that stands out. It speaks volumes. You know, you've got a lot of dramatic elements here. The themes of this film, you're tackling issues of freedom of speech, oppression, discrimination in the workplace when it comes to woman, you know, police officer Moss. The class, the socioeconomic standpoint, a lot of that we see visually, as I said, with Edith looking down from above, thinking that she is superior. Discrimination against women. And the whole, and even the cops, people really don't have that much respect. Which, you've got this really subtle tie-in that I'm curious about. Because so often over the decades, police have been referred to as pigs. And how hilarious is it to have Anne selling her sickly pig in order to raise money to bail Rose out of prison? I got the biggest kick out of that. Was that just happenstance, or did you plan this out with Johnny?
No, we planned that out. the chickens were an unexpected bonus, and the chicken and the bra together in particular was an instinctive move on the day.
Mm-hmm.
But the pigs. The pigs were longstanding.
Those subtleties, a lot of this comes out very nuanced. And in many instances, it's observational. And that's where the pacing comes into play, because you really let us rest on some of these heavier moments without making them maudlin. Was that difficult to find that balance?
You mean in the edit or in the shooting? Of
in the shoot comments? And the edit, because something tells me you were rather economical in your shooting, because this isn't your first rodeo.
Well, I would add to that also that, you know, when you are working with that caliber of actor, they really understood what the beating heart of these characters were. And so those moments of real vulnerability, I think partly it's also what will have attracted, whether it's Olivia or Jesse or Tim Spall, or Angina also to Gladys. She also unexpectedly has moments of you know, real tenderness that you don't see coming
mm-hmm.
as an audience. But it was really delicious to have those moments, those dramatic moments, interspersed with what was otherwise mainly a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And comedy is real, there's real craft behind it. And comedy is tough. It's really hard because making moments, trying to make them work, you know, when something just lands easily, obviously that's wonderful, and to capture it on camera and all of that is brilliant. When it doesn't quite work, but you know it needs to, that's really hard to sort of steer the ship back onto the right terrain, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So it was wonderful to have a script that allowed me to go to both places.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you know, when you list out all the kind of really big subjects that are interlaced within the script, and yet it's a comedy, that is, you know, that is testament to Johnny and his writing from the very beginning.
You know, how surprised were you to find out that this is actually based on a true story from the early 1920s?
Oh my God, I was completely thrown. I had no idea. On my first reading, I had no idea that it was based on a true story. And that the fact that the letters were basically real, and that the most crazy plot maneuvers within the script, again, were real.
Oh my God.
So whether it's the invisible ink or somebody hiding in a letterbox, those things really happened.
Oh my God.
Exactly. So, you know, that for me was just wild and added even more so to me wanting to tell this story.
Did you by any chance actually see any examples of the original letters from the 1920s? Yeah. Now, did you incorporate any of those verbatim?
Yes, absolutely. Most of the letters are real. Most of the wording of the letters come from the real letters.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Wow.
I've seen the handwriting. I mean, I've seen it.
Did you have any trepidation about the language, the foul language, the usage of it in such a large quantity, shall we say, in today's world? It's no worse than reading social media today. I'm curious.
No, I didn't have trepidation at all, because I knew that we had to be careful to get the balance right. I knew that if we went the wrong way and had too much, and you flood it, that would kill it. And similarly, not enough would not make the point. But that was less trepidation than more just an area that I knew I had to be careful with. But no, I think there's something, there's also something so archaic and like Baroque-like almost in the style of the use of the vowel language that is so, I mean, it's both hilarious and intriguing. And there's something also very childish and innocent, actually, I think, about it. And as the film progresses, you realize that this is literally somebody finding a voice
mm-hmm.
and needing to explore something that has been, that's never been allowed to come out. And I don't just mean swearing, but I mean what the swearing stands for
mm-hmm.
and all those feelings that she's had to sit on all these years. So, you know, I think that was the other reason why I never had trepidation, because I understood that there was a much bigger story going on here.
Thank you so much, Thea.
Though. Thank you for your appreciation of the movie.
And hopefully we'll talk in the future.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And that was director Thea Sharrock talking about Wicked Little Letters. It is out. It's streaming. It's on VOD. Theaters, see it. You will laugh your asses off. I guarantee you. And now we're going to switch gears here and talk about some action and espionage and welcome Richard Ryan to the show. Hi, Richard. Are you there?
Hello?
Are you there, Richard?
Oh, yes. I'm here. It's pretty low, though, the volume.
It's pretty low, the volume. Pam, is there anything that you can do about that? Okay, is that better? She's working on it to make it louder.
Okay. I heard Pam's voice fine, but your voice is coming through low for some reason.
I think you might be the first person in history that has said my voice has come through low anywhere.
That's funny.
I am not known for being quiet, ever. Yes, you can put me in an auditorium and you will hear me in the back of the room. So welcome, Richard, Art of Deception.
Yes, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on your radio show. I know you're a true veteran in the game when it comes to that. And so I'm really excited to be on. I just got done working out at the dojo that I work out in Northridge at Mayan Martial Arts. So I'm really excited about that. I'm training for my next films, my next movies, and for life, and it's something I enjoy doing. So it was a great start of the day. It's my grandpa's birthday today.
Oh, well.
Thank you very much. He's in us here with us in spirit. Grandpa Richard, he's actually who I was named after. Yeah, just saw Iron Claw last night, which was amazing. Shout out to Zac Efron and everybody in that film. They did an absolutely fantastic job, and it was very inspiring.
Well, I love the fact that you just came from working out in your dojo, and because martial arts is a key element in Art of Deception. That is what your action sequences are structured around. And, it shows that you do know the craft. I would love to see you end up hooking up with Joe Hallett, who's in the UK. Joe, he runs a martial arts studio there and makes films.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, but it's very key, and we especially see the martial arts where it's particularly effective in Art of Deception with Jackie Nova and her performance. Jackie...
Yeah, she did phenomenal.
She is, with this story, we should give a setup of the story for everybody listening, where CIA, no surprise to most people, CIA has a mind control scheme for, I love this, for global supremacy. And you play a scientist. And, you're just going along and you don't realize what this whole thing is that they're really working on. You finally realize exactly what they're doing. And it's a viral implantation. And coming out of COVID and all adds a degree of an even larger degree of believability to the idea. And once you figure out what's going on, it's you've got to stop this from being spread. You've got to save Jackie's character of Valentina from being abducted. And
right.
So you
and being interrogated, and it was vicious.
So, you as Joseph Markham, you got a lot on your plate here, but the premise itself, and you wrote this, you directed it, your editor on it, your producer on it, you are one of the main leads in this. I love the premise of this film. I love the story concept.
I'm really glad you liked it. You enjoyed it. It's a great film. We really enjoyed making it, and it was definitely a collaborative effort. And I have a lot of honor and respect for those who showed up and played their part, gave their all. And I'm going to bat every single day for them to make Art of Deception a huge success, as I am doing the same with all my other films. And it's kind of interesting because in about 2013, my writing partner, Mike Marcelin, and I worked on a couple projects previous to Art of Deception with him. And we implemented the virus, and this was all pre-COVID, right?
Yeah.
So we implemented the virus, we implemented the chip being implanted to people's minds, and it's actually disintegrated into a serum. So when people take the antidote, they survive, but they have mind control. And the whole talks of Elon Musk implanting chips in people's heads and just all that happened before the virus and in the talks of the chips. So it was before its time pretty much, and now it's perfect timing. The movie's done. And just we're trying every single day just to get it out there in the exposure, just so people can enjoy it and watch it. And I'm really excited about how it all turned out, and people are loving it. So, and we had some really good people on board. Our cinematographer Vishal Solanki is from India. Our composer, we won a lot of awards for our music. Simone Cilio, he's great. We had a true veteran that I learned a lot from in post production. Phase of the, specifically the sound, Patrick Girardi. He's been in the business for about 40 years, and I learned so much from him, and visual effects artists who were in Egypt and India and modern day technology. There's a lot of benefits to it because we're able to collaborate with people from all around the world and make it a global effort without even really meeting them in person. And that's one of the beautiful things about this business is a movie is a platform to be able to cultivate so many great relationships and people with different skill sets and stories and trades and backgrounds, and just under one umbrella and under one mission to make a movie and put it over the finish line. And the process is very militant, which, but also very creative as well. So, I mean, there's a structure, but there's a lot of, you could sort of have a lot of fun and let the creative juices flow within that structure. And so it's a magnificent process having everything come together, and I'm excited and I'm inspired every single day to push the art of deception out there as much as possible.
You know, let me...
And yeah, everybody should watch it.
Let's break the film down here. Where did the idea, the initial idea for Art of Deception come from?
So I actually wrote a treatment, and it was a different title in about 2009, sometime around there, or I completed my second feature film, Natural Demise. And at that time, I was like really fascinated in zeros and ones and binary code and just teetering with ideas of that, where it's pretty phenomenal, these algorithms and how zeros and ones can just lead to so many. I mean, there's so many combinations that could, like, we think nothing of, but there's endless, there's tons of combinations where if we click a button, it does something, mm-hmm. right? We think, like, maybe it types the letter R or a T on the keyboard, or there's endless amount of work that goes involved where we kind of take it for granted. But if we sit back and really dissect it, it's absolutely fascinating. So I started teetering with that a little bit for the my second feature, then put the treatment together. Then I met Jackie Nova like 4 or 5 years later. And then she's a fantastic force, great singer, dancer, actress, of course, can do comedy all the way to combat, to drama, suspense, any genre. So, and all that I've done leading up to that point, and we just both inspired each other. And, one night we had our feet in the pool and we were like, hey, let's make a movie. I know some things, you know some things, let's combine those efforts. And I went to my co-writer, Michael Marcelin, and then, we finalized the script, and then immediately went throughout the process of breaking down the schedule, breaking down the script to create the schedule, the budget, started securing the locations. And, I had my go-to places where I went to pick up equipment for 15 years, actually, or 15 to 17 years when I first started making feature films at McNulty Nielsen over there in North Hollywood, and branched off and went to some other places, like for the props, went to Universal Studios, and just so started securing all the locations and working on the shot list, the storyboard. And then because we didn't have a luxurious budget from the very beginning, we thought it would be a good idea to focus on the financing and developing it specifically after we had an overview of pretty much the whole film and the direction that we're going to. Then we started saying, hey, let's like work on the financing strategy for a few months, and then break down the script even more so in terms of shooting a chunk of the script just one weekend a month. So we would plan for about 3 weeks. We would shoot on one weekend out of the month, and then we would edit after that, and then go back to the drawing board, plan, coordinate, hone in on another chunk of scenes for the weekend, edit, and then just, we did this for a couple years till we had the a rough cut and the principal photography covered. And then at that point we started working on the music and the sound and the visual effects and did some reshoots. So the whole overall process took about 4 years, and then we began our marketing and distribution efforts, which that was a whole nother beast right there. And as an independent filmmaker, a lot of indies get chewed up and spit out alive with, because, I mean, it takes so much effort of to making the movie. Then in post-production, you're ironing out all the mistakes, and there's more money that goes involved with that. So we had to refinance in the post-production phase a bit, so that took a little time. But then, like, you still have to have the stamina to keep going in the marketing and distribution phase, which is a whole nother beast and a whole nother learning curve. We started going to American Film Market. Myself and Jackie started meeting all the sales agents, the distributors. Went to Sundance, picked up some more knowledge over there. And I highly recommend any actors, producers, directors, no matter what capacity you are in the business, go into American Film Market every year. And it's so valuable. Just, of course, there's the creative aspect of making a movie, but then there's the whole business side of it as well, where a lot of creatives don't really want to fully wrap their head around and take advantage of learning all that amazing knowledge and learning, meeting all those contacts, and and really understand the sales and marketing and the distribution side of things, just so you can take your product essentially that you created and you could capitalize on it big time and increase your sales track record and get the movie out there. So then moving forward, once you continue to cultivate the relationships and build relationships with investors and banks, you can say, hey, I have a great financial track record. Look at the success of these previous movies. Now let's move it to the next movie. And that's what I'm doing right now. My next film incorporates military, mafia, and Wall Street. I'm blessed to be able to have the experience, the good, bad, and the ugly for Art of Deception and all the other films, just so I can sort of recreate what worked with some adjustments to make it work even better. And those learning curves that were very challenging and tough, now I can prevent liability. So, but each project, right, you live and you learn and you make it more smooth and have a great experience, not only for yourself, but for everybody that steps on set saying, hey, that's a great set. It's smooth. It was a good time. People go about their days and they talk about how of an amazing set it is and how you treat those people with respect. And it's a great for the camaraderie and morale for not only that project, but the whole entire business. And it means everything, you know, to be able to just have the opportunity to work with such amazing, incredible people every single day and do what I do. And I'm inspired every day and I'm blessed.
You know, now you just mentioned something. You've mentioned a few key points that I want to try and touch on here. Number one, you mentioned the challenges. What did you find to be the most challenging aspect of making Art of Deception? Was it, you know, shooting on weekends, having it drawn out for so many years, the financing? What would you say was the most challenging aspect for you to bring Art of Deception to life?
So I would say the most challenging aspects lied in post-production, right? Because the budget was bigger. There was a lot more on the line. And I didn't have the true post-production the treatment that went involved with Art of Deception post-production-wise. It wasn't to that extent on Art of Deception as it was for my previous films. So I just repeated what I've done before, which obviously with a bigger budget though, and obviously I grew as an actor filmmaker, and but we were able to secure the locations and the insurance and rent the equipment and have the money and I maxed out all the credit cards and so did Jackie, and we had residuals from the commercials that we did, and we worked jobs, you know. I was working even at the time and sometimes in post-production for simultaneously working on the movie, working 20-hour days doing Uber and Lyft and DoorDash. It was all in. But yeah, like going to the equipment rental place and the casting and getting the crew together, scheduling, budgeting. I've never really had a problem with with doing all of that. So it was just, it was fun, right? It was great. It was effortless. And then, but you get into post-production and, those things that you didn't know that were going to be a problem necessarily on set. Well, now you have to deal with it in post. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely technical with the audio and the visual effects. Like, for example, in visual effects, like, you can shoot the green screen. It could come out great. Green screen on a computer, it could come out great. But unless you have exactly what's planned to go onto that green screen, then you have to, like, you have this sequence that you have to figure out now what's going to go on that green screen and finding the visual effects artist and being very meticulous with the look and if it makes sense with the story, or if the audio wasn't captured properly on set, then you got to do the ADR, and you got to, like, if you have different boom operators, they might have operated the audio at different frame rates. So now the that's off a little bit. That has to be conformed. And, there's just a lot of technicality, and it's wearing because, like, it's very tedious and knowing how you can work on something for so long in the post-production phase. And there's a lot of notes. So it's a lot of back and forth with all this, like, all the workflow and the color grading, and there might be dead pixels. And then, or you very meticulous with the color grade and then working around everybody's schedules, because in post-production I had some great, real good professional, like I said, Patrick Girardi with sound, great colors, great visual effects, and what could take, pretty short, relatively speaking, if you had the budget, you could put in a bunch of money right away and have it done. That mistake that you made, like, a week or two, but because if you ran out of money, you might have to, like, again, work 20-hour days doing Uber and 24-hour mm-hmm. days in Uber and work around these true professionals' schedules, that they're worth the wait, because there needs to be some things that can be fixed, or that has to be fixed and do it in a way where it serves the film to the best ability. And it takes a while to find people that care, because maybe there's people out there, you got to feel them out. Do they want it just for a paycheck and they don't really care about the quality of the work, or do they actually care about the quality of the work and they're going to go above and beyond and really have that bond and teach you and teach me in the process as well. So I would say in the post-production phase, but it's and figuring out, like, the quality control. And there's so many aspects where you can't get a sales agent that you get a sales agent, then you got to go through quality control, and that's another expense, and you have to fix a lot of other things as well. So, but all this is as challenging as it was and gut-wrenching at times as it was, and like getting the DCP and putting it so it can go into the theater mm-hmm. and arranging it and figuring all that out and coordinating the theater, the red carpet premiere and all these things, all these elements. And maybe there's distributors or sales agents that don't value your work. And they make up all these marketing costs so you don't ever see a dime mm-hmm. and they don't market it and distribute it in a way that you feel that they should, the individual attention that it deserves, because they have a lot of other films that they have to worry about, which is 150 films, you know. But now, this day and age, there's a lot of advantage to things because you can self-distribute. You can get it on Tubi, you can get it on Amazon Prime, you can go to Apple TV mm-hmm. and you can be in charge of your distribution more, and then get a great marketing team like Epic Media Group. They've been awesome, and they just truly cared. And I went through like 8 months worth of just finding the right people that weren't just going to take the money for a paycheck. Like, they actually truly cared. And that was a whole big process. And you have to have a lot of patience involved too, because you're so eager to get it out there and you want to do it. But there's patience because the quality has to be there with the post-production, the marketing, the distribution. But once you figure all this out, you go through it, and then the next project, and it's challenging, but when you don't give up, you keep pushing through, you're forced to learn all of these things, or you don't. If you give up, that's bad for you, that's bad for everybody that showed up for you, that believed in your project. But if you keep moving forward, you learn all these things, so then the next project, you can prevent all of these mistakes. I don't like to use the word mistakes, but learning curves that you had, so you can make the project more smooth, and you can plan a project, and you can know how to get the money in a realistic type of fashion, because I've been to American Film Market. I go to film festivals. I talk to a lot of producers and directors and tons of people in the industry. I've done the accounting. I've done so many hats, like pretty much all of them. And but like now I know from a psychological standpoint what each department goes through and what they feel and what's important to them, so I can plan accordingly and allow people to have a great experience, because I want everybody to have a great experience that steps on set. So going through all this stuff, like I said, is challenging at times, but once you figure it out, you just have a lot more understanding, and you're comfortable with just all that you know. So,
you know, having gone through this experience with Art of Deception, because you are wearing so many hats here, for your next projects, do you think that you will take off some of those hats and bring in other people, perhaps to do the editing? Or, you know, instead of you as being one of the lead actors, cast somebody else, just so you can limit some of your focus and hone in
right,
on, you know, focus more instead of being so spread out.
Right. Yeah, totally good question. So since I've done 17 short films and 3 feature films, I know how to just, like, with all that, you know, my hats were producer, director, writer, actor, editor. But also, I was the post-production suit. Like, on paper, that's what I gave my credits for. But I also did post-production supervisor, accounting, financing, just so many. I probably did, like, 50 or 60 positions if you really want to get technical with it. But moving forward, yeah, on paper, if it's a script that I wrote, like I'm gonna, a lot of times it might be for me. But moving forward, I might write a script and maybe it's not for me. Maybe I give myself a cameo, like I did on my second short film, or my second feature, and I've done that in a couple other shorts. But my next one, initially, yeah, I'm gonna be the lead actor again. I'm going to obviously be the producer and director and writer, but I'm not going to edit it. I'm going to have oversight of each department, because that's what I like. But I'm not going to edit it. I'll be there in the editing room and stuff. But I also did all the line producing, the production coordinating, et cetera, but moving forward now, I know who to hire and who is good for the project and who's not good for the project. But, I've been just really appreciative to cultivate so many relationships over the years, being on set and working with people. And, I believe now moving forward, and, I develop a project for a while, and I don't and like I let the pieces materialize before me. So instead of like saying, hey, I need this, let me go out and find them. No, I'm just always constantly networking, always on set, always out there where maybe I meet somebody and okay, perfect fit. You're my production designer. And this particular gentleman has worked on 500 plus projects, or you're my AD because now I met you at Sundance and we cultivated this relationship. You're my line producer. You're my production coordinator. You're my production manager. You're my stunt coordinator because I met you 16 years ago and now you're, mm-hmm. you have your own stunt company and you have your own team. So I make you my stunt coordinator, but he has like 20 of his own stunt team people. So there we go. Mm-hmm. Or there's my DP because I was referred to him by somebody else who I had a meeting with, who I just previously met. And it's sort of an effortless flow of like, okay, you're the DP. Okay. You have your own gaffer, your own grip, your own lighting team. So the chemistry is built in already, or, you're my key makeup artist because you have your whole team because professionals have their own team, their whole team. And heck, I met my going down all the way to the craft service and PAs. Like I know I worked on a Hulu project a few years ago, this husband and wife craft service team. I know they were nothing but respectful. They had such amazing, great attitudes. And, I know for a fact I want to have it any other way. They're my craft service team. Or I was at American Film Market and I had my whole lookbook for my next film. And I was talking to these other filmmakers. I gave it to the composer and the composer, was looking through at my lookbook and it was literally speaking. It was speaking to the composer. So he started telling me ideas that he was having just by looking at that imagery. So, and the same thing happens with financing too. Like if my project speaks to you and you're passionate about it and it's just, it's speaking to you, spiritually and just professionally, it's a good fit. Nothing's forced. I don't want to force anything and have to sell anybody. And, cause that's a recipe for, okay, there's going to be mistakes on set. There's going to be an individual on set that isn't really 100% passionate about stepping on set for this particular project and might carry an attitude and it'll trickle to the other departments. And now you have this problem instead of like everybody being on set, having a great attitude, a great gratitude and, having a sense of intimacy and professionalism and respect. And that all starts from the top. And, mm-hmm. That's how I develop my projects. And so when it comes to the hats also, and like I'm able to direct in the produce is the coordinating it all, right? You're in charge of all the elements, mm-hmm. the acting and having a great team. And I'm able to direct because I'm essentially directing in the development stages of it. And, by coordinating with everything, the composer, the designers, the look, the imagery of it and having a trustworthy AD that is on set to be able to say, hey, this is your responsibility. When I'm into my character completely, your responsibility is to make sure everything is executed the way that I envisioned. And then, of course, he's going to have some ideas as well, right? Because it's a team effort. But so on set, and then ahead of time, like I'm a firm believer in actually going – instead of shooting, we go to the set and have that tech walkthrough and with the keys, right? With the production, mm-hmm. with the director of photography, with the lighting, the audio. So he knows exactly where he's going to set up his equipment. We know ahead of time what the camera movements are going to be, what the shots are going to be, where the lighting is going to be at a particular time. So when, And as we're shooting one scene, the B team is setting up their equipment, in setting up for the next shot. So then the A team comes over, it's plug and play. So it's a very efficient, smooth process. And there's no guessing games on the day of shooting. There's no, oh, what are we shooting? Let's figure out what shots we're going to do now. And everybody's running around with chickens with their heads cut off. And I've seen the most professional shoots with big budgets that are like that. But it is sort of a commonality of like, it should be like that. That's part of the process, but it doesn't need to be. So, so wearing the hats now, it's important with the compartmentalization. And when I have an editor on board who's editing as we go. And then so, to answer your question for the next project, just for a peace of mind, just to put breath in my lungs when I work it in this business, and just saving just gut wrenching moments and trauma. Like I need a good sized budget with a great team and great planning. Because when it comes to shooting and filming and in the post production phase, it's sometimes just will destroy you. And I don't want that. I want the whole process to be enjoyable. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's been a lot of enjoyment, but there's been a lot of challenging times too. But I want, even during those challenging times, work with amazing, great people every step of the way that feeds me and puts breath in my lungs. When there's a stressful situation, you alleviate my stress, and then vice versa. I want everybody on set to be inspired also. And that's the way it should be.
Well, unfortunately,
building teams, I love doing it. So absolutely.
Unfortunately, Richard, we are all out of time. We've gone over, as I typically do. It has been wonderful having you on the show. Now, quickly tell people, I know that the film is available on Tubi. Is Art of Deception available on any other platforms right now?
Yeah, so Art of Deception is available on Tubi and Amazon Prime and a couple other platforms like Woku. And I always say for people to go to my website, auxfilms.us, and there's a feature film tab, there's a short film tab where you can see all my features, all my short films, my social medias on there. You can see the behind-the-scenes making of. So there's a lot of art deceptions, so you see us going through the process. So there's educational value there as well as entertainment. You see some of the interviews and red carpet premieres that we did. And
the bottom line is people can see Art of Deception. Go to Tubi, go to Amazon Prime, Prime Video. Those are probably the two biggest ones. And you know, watch it and enjoy it and look for more from you.
Yeah, look for it big time. And, shout out to Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. I just saw Roadhouse as well. Amazing film. And I just wrapped up a commercial a couple of days ago with the UFC and Shane Collins, MMA fighter. Look out for him. And I want to give a shout out to my dojo, Dan and Myed and Liam over there at Myed Martial Arts, and Ricky Keelis, you know, four-time title belt holder. And Patrick Girardi, I mentioned him,
yep.
Jackie Nova, my mom, my dad, you know, my whole family, grandpa, it's his birthday today. And I know I feel him strongly in spirit. And check out my films. I'm looking to build opportunities every single day. And thank you very much. I'm inspired and honored to be on your show.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. And you go have a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bless you, and have a great day as well.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
And that was producer, writer, director, editor, actor, line producer, jack of all trades, on Art of Deception. It is out now on Tubi, Prime Video. Check it out. And my review of the film, it's on Rotten Tomatoes. For those of you that forget sometimes, because I haven't been writing as many reviews as I should. I've been doing so many interviews the past couple years versus reviews, but I'm starting to get back into more of the reviews that'll be on Rotten Tomatoes and on my website, behindthelensonline.net. Check out my review after hearing this interview and see the film. And that is all the time we have. I don't know yet what's going on next week. I haven't gotten confirmation. Annie, if you're listening, I need an email. But I'll be here. So until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. Oh, and go see Wicked Little Letters. Please, please, please sit at home, laugh your ass off, go to the theater, Wicked Little Letters, see it. I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.